sailboats and sports cars displayed on everyone's plot of suburban green rayon. This is the stuff that philosophers prey on, dreaming.
Gabriel Kahane is a songwriter, singer, pianist, composer, a guitarist, and a banjo player. Recently, he made a recital debut at Carnegie's Zankel Hall in a program devoted to original music. As a songwriter, he's released two albums, most recently the critically acclaimed Where Are the Arms, which was hailed by the New York Times for its extravagant poise and emotional intelligence. As a composer of concert works, Kahane has been commissioned by, among others, Carnegie Hall, the LA Philharmonic, American Composers Orchestra, the Kronos Quartet, the Karamur Festival, and the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. Equally at home in divergent musical realms, Gabriel has performed or recorded with artists ranging from Sufjan Stevens, Rufus Wainwright, mandolin wizard Chris Teal, jazz pianist Brad Medlow, Jeremy Dank, Alisa Weilerstein, and composer-conductor John Adams. In anticipation of Gabriel Kahane's appearance at Soho Club and Restaurant this week, courtesy of UCSB Arts and Lectures, I had the opportunity to speak with Gabriel by phone.
So you're coming to Santa Barbara.
I am indeed. I'm so looking forward to getting out of Polar Vortex 2.
Yeah, have they called it that?
They have been calling that indeed.
Yeah. Wow. You're going to be doing a little California tour. You'll be part of the Laguna Music Festival, I guess. Laguna Beach.
Yeah, I think I have some funny title like guest artistic director or something like that, and so I'll be there for a week.
Oh, nice.
Doing concerts in various formats with various cohorts and family members.
Good. Fine. Let's see, you did come through Santa Barbara, I think maybe 2011.
Yes, with Alisa.
Eight. Good. Is that the only time you've played here in the past?
I think so. Recollection tells me that I have not made it either far enough south or far enough north in the past to get to Santa Barbara.
Your father's been a part of the Music Academy of the West in the past, I guess.
Yeah, I think he has quite a bit of history playing in the area, and it is as a native Californian, everyone is envious of folks who live in Santa Barbara because it is just the most beautiful place.
Now the venue you'll be playing at is a little bit different than Hahn Hall, where you were with Alisa.
So I understand. I've never been there, but it's a club, yeah.
Yeah, it is. They're pretty eclectic, I think. It'll be interesting to see what you think.
I'm certainly looking forward.
It's pretty much the main sort of popular cutting edge music club there is in town. I mean, it's pretty,
I see.
Yeah. So, and you've been you'll be singing some things from your Where Are the Arms album, but you're also working on a new album to be released this year, is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, we're actually going to be doing primarily a kind of preview of new music from this record called The Ambassador, which is all sort of centered around songs about Los Angeles architecture. Each song is for a building, a different building in Los Angeles. This is going to be one of the first opportunities to play that music live. I'm really excited for its release. I think so late spring, early summer. It's going to be my first major label record with Sony Masterworks. And after 5 or 6 years of doing the DIY thing, I'm sort of ready to be, I wouldn't necessarily say pampered, but to have folks who really know what they're doing looking after the release of an album.
Right. Now, when I hear Sony Masterworks, I'm usually thinking of concert hall music.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a new guy there, Chuck Mitchell, who's a veteran of the industry, who's been installed there to lead the division. And I think that they're sort of reconceiving Masterworks as a home for, you know, we're living in this kind of genreless moment where we hear, you know, Steve Mackey play an electric guitar concerto with the LA Philharmonic, or we hear string quartets playing in bars, or as we will at the Soho, have a chamber ensemble by music playing in a club. And I think that the notion that Masterworks is running with is they want to present work that is masterful regardless of genre. So I guess I'm sort of honored and humbled to be part of that new mission.
Cool. You like to write about places.
Yes, guilty as charged. Guilty as charged. I have not really been able to shake that. I guess it began in 2005. There was this building in Brooklyn called the Underberg Building, which was a kitchen supply store, which was torn down to make way for the recently opened Barclays Center in the what had been the Atlantic Rail Yards near my old home in Brooklyn. And I wrote a song about that, and that sort of led to my interest in the house at 7 Madah, which was the subject of the musical February House that I wrote that was presented at the Public Theater a few years back, which was, you know, sort of an evening-length exploration of one structure. And now with Los Angeles, you know, I was born there, but I didn't grow up there. And I've just found myself increasingly, as I've returned as an adult, really moved by the city and trying to understand what it is about the city that I find so kind of emotionally gripping. There is, of course, the cliche, the dismissive cliche that comes, you know, either from the north, from San Francisco, or from the East Coast about how superficial, you know, film and TV culture is. But I'm really sort of interested in the underbelly and the heart of Los Angeles, and the way that I decided I was going to try to access that was through a bunch of buildings that I found interesting, either for architectural reasons or because of historical moments that were really linked to those buildings. For example, the title track, the Ambassador Hotel.
Right.
Of course, you know, the site of RFK's assassination. There are, you know, other things. There are the Empire Liquor Mart, which was in South Central, where in 1991, young woman Latasha Harlins was shot about 9 to 12 months before Rodney King, before the Rodney King beating. And so I've written a long, almost like a 9 or 10 minute piece that sort of explores the background, the sort of socio-demographic background that led to the tension between the Korean community and the Black community, and the Black migration in the 1940s and 50s. And then there are also some very lighthearted and silly things about, you know, why do villains always live in houses built by modernist masters, and the action movies of the 1980s, Die Hard, and 1990s crime films like Michael Mann's Heat. So it's pretty all over the map.
That sounds great. That sounds great. I'm looking forward to it for sure. You wrote a piece, maybe it was a song cycle or something, based on a Hart Crane poem. Is that right?
Yeah,
Crane
Palimpsest. That's right. That was for Who was that for?
That was actually a co-commission between American Composers Orchestra and my father's orchestra, ACO.
And actually in that piece,
I sort of, I was exploring the literal idea of the Brooklyn Bridge and then also this metaphorical idea of the musical worlds that I inhabit. And on the one hand, I really love folk songs. I love Paul Simon and Joni Mitchell, and that's a tradition that I feel like to come out of. And then on the other hand, I really love kind of steely modernism of the 20th century and the 21st century, you know, music by Bartok and Stravinsky and Thomas Addis and Gheorghe Ligeti. And so there was this attempt to kind of reconcile those two worlds through a setting of Crane's poem and then also some lyrics that I had written as a kind of response to Crane's poem. And yeah, it was a really fun piece to work on.
Now, did you say you found out you lived in the February house? Or
no.
No. That house was wrecked. That
house was wrecked. No, what is the case is that at the time that I was writing it, my collaborator, Seth Buckley, is a wonderful playwright, director, and actor. He would frequently, in the early days, I was living in a small apartment in Park Slope, Brooklyn, about, I don't know, 2 miles from where the February house had stood. And there was only my bedroom and then the room with the piano, and so we ended up buying an air mattress, and he would sleep under the piano on this air mattress. And so we sort of thought of ourselves as living in our own kind of 7 minute February house, but I was not actually living there.
Let's see. Speaking of Joni Mitchell, I was doing a little research for this conversation with you, and I had not heard of Shara Warden before. What a fabulous voice she has, and it does remind me a little bit of Joni Mitchell.
She's a very special character, all in her own mold. She's an extraordinary artist, both as a songwriter and as a composer, and just a beautiful human being. And actually just been recording with her over the internet. She's in Detroit and sang some background vocals for the new album, which I'm really excited about because there's really no one who sings quite like her.
I really get that sense. I mean, I was thrilled to stumble upon her. I was forwarding some of the YouTube performances to my daughter. I was like, you got to hear this woman.
Yeah. she's so special.
Yeah, that's cool. You studied with Fred Hirsch.
I did. Are you a Fred fan?
I am a Fred fan. I had a little email correspondence with him about a year or so ago because somebody gave me he had set Leaves of Grass. For the 150th anniversary of the publication Leaves of Grass, and I realized when he was working on that, I was writing a play at the time that we did right around the same time. So anyway, I just wanted to tell him, and he had me send him the DVD. It's not a very good quality DVD, but he wanted to hear it, see it anyway. So
he was a big influence on me early in my musical life when I sort of thought of myself as a jazz pianist. I ultimately found that there were just other avenues that I think sort of suit me more. I leave the improvising to the professionals.
I love some of the things you've written or spoken about in interviews about, you know, loosening the tie or bringing informality back into the concert hall, and the whole notion that somehow that music is frozen and cut off from an engagement in everyday life and current affairs and all of that, that the life of the artist has to have an intercourse between you know, the abstract musical discipline and the artifacts of everyday life. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, certainly. You know, I don't think that informality should be brought into the concert hall for the sake of as a strategy, as some sort of cynical strategy to, you know, make people feel a certain way. I just think that the informality of the concert, or rather the formality of the concert hall, frequently feels so mired in artifice to me. And, you know, there are these the ongoing conversations about do we not clap between movements?
Yeah.
I was at Carnegie Hall to hear my friend Jonathan Biss play the other night, and after the first movement of Waldstein, the whole audience erupted into applause, and I thought, yes, this is great. This is an audience that is unselfconscious about the fact that when something has a big finish, the composer probably means for you to clap. And it's, you know, it's a sort of quietus interruptus to not allow oneself that response. And I mean, that's just one instance of these kinds of barriers. I mean, if we want people to engage in the music of the past, I think that we need to present it in a way that feels organic and natural. And I'm not necessarily a believer in a lot of the what appear to me kind of desperate and cynical strategies of bringing in new audiences, you know, the video game symphony or whatever, these kinds of tired modes of bringing in new audiences that don't really stick. But I do think that to get on stage and to talk to the audience as though one were having a conversation with friends in a living room is a way to kind of disarm and diffuse any kind of discomfort or tension. And also, I suppose there are some artists who really rely on a kind of mystery in terms of the persona that they bring to the stage. And I don't think that's particularly who I am. I think I am a pretty straightforward and unadorned presence.
Right.
And I don't mean that in a self-congratulatory way, but just that I don't... Shara, for example, is someone who I think has an incredible mystique, and she, without really being artificial, has this extraordinary kind of mysterious presence on stage.
Mm.
And whereas I sort of feel like there's not very much of a difference between you and I speaking on the phone now and the way that I will relate to an audience when I'm on stage, except that perhaps I might be more self-deprecating on stage.
There was a NPR blog post talking about bad lyrics that you noticed and reposted, and I was really glad to see that. can you say something about how you approach things I think of you as a poet, a lyricist, and what you
that's very flattering.
Yeah.
I think my gripe with the current moment is that there's such extraordinary attention, and a lot of the music that I'm interested in that's being made by my contemporaries, there's frequently an incredible amount of attention put into how it sounds from a, you know, sonic standpoint, stereo image. What are the reverbs? What are the delays? What are the amplifiers? What are the miking techniques? And so on and so forth. What are the synthesizers? How are the strings? Mics and so on and so forth. But I frequently have the sense that a lot of this music is going out the door with a first draft of lyrics. I remember reading a review by one of the Times music critics of some major album saying, it seems like this record went to press with dummy lyrics in place, and dummy lyrics being a sort of...
Right, like an algebra, like placeholders in algebra or something.
Yeah, exactly, precisely. And I think that the more... I think partly through writing for the theater, where you only have one chance to get the lyric across to the audience member, which does, in a way, set musical theater lyric writing apart from pop song lyric writing. they are very different endeavors. But one of the things that I've tried to sort of bring back from my work in the theater is that theater lyrics require a different level of precision because, you know, as I said, you only have one shot at communicating the idea or the progression of ideas or the emotional transformation from one state to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're imprecise with a preposition or a verb or it's too flowery, you can very easily lose the listener's attention or lose their experience of the story that you're trying to tell. And so I've become kind of a relentless editor, which doesn't mean that I don't still write bad lyrics sometimes. but I think that I just try to be as kind of cold and ruthless with editing lyrics as I am with music. I think writing text is something that came much later for me. I didn't start until my early 20s, and I think I began in a place of real lack of self-consciousness because I knew I was terrible at it, and that was sort of okay. And the more that I've sort of tried to refine that craft, the more it becomes pulling teeth in the same way that writing music is, mm-hmm. is pulling teeth. But right. then I think, you know, on a sort of more general level, for me, it's 80% of the time it's about storytelling. 20% of the time it's maybe about mood, being a little bit more abstract, dealing, trafficking in images or the sounds of words that add up to something that is evocative. But I think I do, for the most part, just try to think about storytelling and what is the most efficient and distilled way to tell a story that is, you know, at once singular, universal but not cliched, and you know, shedding light on some kind of narrative that feels new.
You've said that the humanities, I guess you didn't go to the Music Conservatory, you've said the humanities were more influential on you, on your musical, on the way you approach music than technical musical training itself. Is it, do I have that right? Your studies in English and history and philosophy.
Well, I think what I really mean is that being at an institution where a kind of broad liberal arts view of the world was encouraged, I was able to sort of apply that to music. And I think there are so many people who can run circles around me technically in any of the disciplines that I engage in as an artist, but I think I've been able to sort of find a place for myself in the cultural sphere because I'm maybe trying to look at the world in a broad, empathetic way and applying sort of my experience or refracting my experience of the world into the work that I do. And I think certainly the professors that I had in the humanities just encouraged me to be a broad thinker. And, you know, one of my inspirations is certainly John Adams in the way that I feel like he is much more than a composer. He is one of the great orchestrators, and he has a supremely great sense of harmony. But I think that his standing in the musical world is as much to do with his worldview and his intellect and the way that he brings all of that to bear on his music as it is the sort of technical things that he brings to the table.
Yeah. What is this about the WPA? Is that FDR's Works Progress Administration? Are you
writing a song cycle or something about
that? Yeah, that actually premiered last April.
Oh.
That was for Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, and it was a piece that I wrote using, I don't know if you're familiar with the WPA guides.
No. Mm-mm.
So you know, among the arms, the various arms of the WPA, there was the Federal Theater Project, there was the Federal Art Project, within the Theater Project there was the Dance Project, and then there was also the Federal Writers Project, and one of the conundrums that they faced politically was that the right side of the political spectrum was so resistant to putting writers to work, sitting in their rooms, drawing a federal paycheck, writing novels. This was just not going to fly.
Yeah.
And so someone or a consortium of people had the bright idea to commission a series of travel guides for each of the 48 states that would be written by unemployed writers. So you have this incredible moment where you have folks like a young John Cheever, Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, Zora Neale Hurston, Saul Bellow, and then, of course, many, many others who did not go on to illustrious careers, writing copy for travel guides. And the thing that's so fabulous about it is that there's no attribution in any of the guides.
Yeah.
So you read this incredible prose about Chicago, and you're left to think, well, this sounds an awful lot like Saul Bellow, but I don't know if it actually is or not. And so I've made this libretto out of text from, 15 or 20 of these guides, and kind of crafted a tour of the country all through text from these travel guides.
Okay.
Which I then did with Orpheus. And I'm hoping there will be a California premiere sometime in the 15-16 season. 2015 is the 80th anniversary of the founding of the WPA.
Oh.
And there may also be a recording released in 2015.
That is great. So, now, was that your idea?
It was and it wasn't. Orpheus came to me with the desire for a piece broadly about the WPA.
Huh.
And when I was starting to think about what I was going to write, I felt like we were sort of so mired in this, healthcare political morass that if I were to do something that was, third person, my own text, the sort of biopic, the song cycle equivalent of the biopic of the WPA, that it was going to be sort of excessively ideological. And the piece probably is, even just by using those texts, it is inherently laden with some degree of ideology, but I thought that if I could sort of get out of the way of commenting on that era and just let the era sort of speak for itself, that might be a sort of more even-handed way of dealing with that era. And then I think also, there are so few people who know about these guides, which I think are an incredible literary moment in our country's history, and many of the most literate people just don't know that they exist because they were some of them fell out of print. They're all back in print now, but it's just a moment that I think deserves to be heard more. And I think, in many cases, the writing is much more beautiful than the music that I've set to it. And I'm just sort of glad to be giving people a window into these guidebooks so that they can perhaps pick up the edition for their state.
How did you learn orchestration?
Well, the tense of your verb there is perhaps dubious. only in the sense that I think it's a lifelong process.
Yeah.
And I consider myself, the more I know, as is the case in so many disciplines, the more I know, the more I realize how little I know.
Oh, yeah.
But I actually do feel like the WPAP behavioral guide was the first one where I felt like there were some gestures in the orchestration that I felt like were really coming from me as opposed to from some idea that I had pilfered. Although a great deal of orchestration is really just stealing from stuff that you like. So
mm-hmm.
I've mostly studied a lot of scores, both of folks who are dead and also from my colleagues. Andrew Norman, who as you might know, just was appointed to professorship of composition at USC, is a good friend of mine. And he's an orchestrator whom I very, very deeply admire. And so I'm stealing stuff from him all the time. And, you know, it's pretty unapologetic in our world. We look at the scores of people we like and try to make things our own that we admire.
Right. Why Music was born from the piece that you composed based on Robert Lowell's poetry, is that right? From Union Dead, was that the first time Why Music came to birth?
Yes and no. I mean, they were my friends Rob and CJ, who are the sort of co-founders of that group.
Right.
They were talking about starting a chamber ensemble that comprised musicians who were sort of equally comfortable touring with rock bands and playing with orchestras and playing chamber music. And right at the time that they were ready to sort of birth this thing, I had been invited to write a piece for the Verbier Festival in Switzerland. And because I had no experience writing chamber music, I thought, oh, maybe I should write this piece for this ensemble and we can play it a couple times in advance of it being played in Switzerland. The joke being that it was never played in Switzerland due to a series of administrative fiascos. But Why Music and I have played that piece several times, and it was actually the first time that they played together in performance.
Right. Well, it really does seem that you are finding a place for yourself, for sure. And it seems like you and Rob and CJ and Shara, it seems like you guys are all on the edge of something entirely new. You know, and it's really exciting to look into your story a little bit for me.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that is the case. I mean, I think we're also, as much as it would be wonderful to take credit for doing something new, I think we're also reviving some traditions that are very old. I think the spirit of the salon is not so dissimilar from what we're doing now. And there was just this moment. I mean, this is sort of, I sound like a broken record when I say this, but we're at a little bit too close a distance to this dark moment of the kind of high modernism of the 1950s where the Academy kind of strangled populism. And I think if you take that aberration out of the narrative of, concert music, whatever you want to call it, there's always been a connection between the vernacular and what's in the concert hall, from, Bartok using Magyar folk songs, from Bach using folk tunes in the Goldberg variations, Mozart, Schumann, Schubert, Mahler. There's it's a very long tradition of a marriage of the two, and I think we're just sort of bringing that back as opposed to reinventing the wheel.
Are you aware of that cellist Matt Heimowitz a few
yes.
10 years ago or so? He kind of left the concert hall for a while and he went around to pizza joints and bars and cafes playing the cello suites. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, he was certainly ahead of this curve, and I really don't want to take any credit for for anything that is not my doing.
Yeah, but you're adding a whole nother level to it. It's exciting, and your versatility is really impressive.
Well, thanks. Thank you.
Yeah. So let me see. Indulge me for a moment. What in Calabash and Catamaran, what is the device? Is it an Orwellian reference to TV?
That's a secret that I cannot divulge. I think that it's funny that you asked about that song because those are some of the most elliptical lyrics certainly on that album, and for me it's actually about something very, very specific, but I think the moment that I reveal that, the song would become
right
banal.
No pressure for me. No, I mean that's the beauty of it, is it grabs you with its calypso beat, and it's a great thing to listen to. I like a certain opacity in lyrics because they, you know, it's like my love of poetry. You know, it's you've got to water it, you've got to heat it up with your attention for it to give you something back, and sometimes it only gives you your own reflection, you know.
I remember having a conversation with a producer at Lincoln Center who started to ask me a question about the lyrics to a song of mine, and then he said, wait, don't tell me. And then he launched into the story about how much he loves Joni Mitchell and how he had heard her on, I think it was on Fresh Air or some radio program, where she was talking about the genesis of some lyrics for songs of hers. And this producer was saying that it totally ruined those songs for him to have a specific meaning assigned to them, and that I think that is, it's so dangerous when, as a listener, we frequently both want to know and don't want to know what the lyrics are about, because we assign our own meaning, and that's part of the joy of, you know, living with a song.
Yeah, it's almost like a wrapped gift or something. You know, if the artist unwraps it, then you're done. But if it's not unwrapped, then every time I go to it, I can puzzle over it again, and I can approach it anew, and it still remains wrapped. And I kind of like that. You know.
Right. Yes. Absolutely.
It's wonderful. Did you know that Chris Teal is playing the night before you are here in town?
I had no idea that Chris was going to be in town. That is quite funny. Is he playing solo?
I think he's with an ensemble. It's not UCSB Arts and Lectures. It's CAMA, the Community Arts and Music Association, is bringing him in.
I'll have to have dinner with him.
Yeah, I was thinking you two ought to busk, you know, in one of the parking lots or something, and
I'll leave the busking to him. He is such a joy to play music with and to listen to play music.
He's amazing. I found out about him through Michael Lawrence's film on Bach and Friends. You know,
I discovered that
you know, all those bluegrassy guys were all getting into Bach. Mostly because of the double bass player, I forget his name right now.
Edgar Meyer.
Yes. Yeah.
Edgar is sort of an intellectual father to that whole community.
That's right. That's what I got the sense of that. And Teal plays one of those, you know, one of the violin sonatas, and it's just unbelievable. It's like,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, he is really one of my top musicians alive, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's breaking all the, you know, all the boundaries too. I mean, there's such a great, I don't know, I just feel like what you guys are doing is alive, you know.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way. I mean, I think we are trying to keep the level of artistry at, you know, at the highest level, but also I mean, to be crude, to bring it to the people a little bit more.
Yes.
And, you know, as someone who grew up totally immersed in classical music because of my father's career, I still find it highly alienating to sit in, you know, certain kind of shoebox concert halls with that ritual. It just doesn't feel comfortable to me, as much as I love that music. And if there's a way to sort of express, to play that repertoire in such a way that people who don't have my level of comfort with the music could feel, or to put it another way, if I feel discomfort in the concert hall, I can only imagine what someone who didn't grow up immersed in it would feel.
Right.
So I do think that, that maybe has something to do with why we're doing what we're doing.
Well, it's great. And even though you describe the music of Where Are the Arms as pop, I love all the instrumental breakouts and stuff. They're really sophisticated, and that's great. I mean, I know you don't want to be pedagogical, but it means people who would be drawn into it because for the pop music are going to get some really cool sounds in their ears that they're not going to get any other way. You know, that's.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad to hear you say that. I mean, I do think, in part, I'm such a kind of ADD listener that I always want a certain amount of ear candy, and you know, I'm at the moment very much immersed in the final stages of mixing the new album, and we're sort of putting all of the decorative stuff, if you will, not that it's strictly decorative. But a lot of those things that you refer to are there both because they feel architecturally significant, but also because they capture my interest as a listener and I think bring a different kind of, I don't know, a different emotional register to the music. So I'm glad that did something for you.